Aloha, everybody. This is Kathy Bilski, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show on UPRN Radio. This is Friday, October 22nd, 2021. Today, I have a guest coming on my show, and he's really incredible. If there was a better survivalist, I don't know who he would be. And his name is Stefan Verstappen. He's been on my show before. And he's written a new book on creating a complete community, which is really, really cool. And before I bring him on, I wanted to talk really quickly about the December 24th, 2021, this year, the World Enlightenment Event, where we're all coming together for 5 minutes or 1 hour to really call in and anchor divine enlightenment on the planet and all life forms. So mark your calendar. We're going to be on radio, which is really cool. And whatever other mediums we can get on at that time. So everyone can join us. Now, I like to chant, and that's what I will be doing for the full hour. And the basic chant is, may divine enlightenment descend on everyone now. May divine enlightenment awaken within everyone now. And you say that 3 times, and you go to another chant. You just tweak it a little bit. May divine enlightenment descend on the Nazis now. May divine enlightenment awaken within the Nazis. May divine enlightenment descend on all the children now. I think you get it. So I will also post the chants that I will be doing. But really, I don't care how you do it. Whether you dance enlightenment down, you sing it, you meditate by yourself. Well, you know, get a group of people together and do a group meditation. You know, there's a lot of ways that we can pull in enlightenment. So we're not limited to one way. Whatever works for you, it's all intent. And when you speak it, you're using the power of the spoken word, and we are into creation. And the more energy we put out there, and we can have a huge quantum leap. And what does that mean? That's helping people really reconnect to the creator and to become an awakened spiritual being that knows better. And when that happens, everything else will fall into place and everyone's lessons will be easier. I shouldn't say lessons, but their missions, okay? Because people will know and they will see it. Now, you can also go to the forum. And it's worldenlightenment2021.org. And I'll spell that for you. worldenlightenment2021.org. I know. What was I thinking? That was long, but enlightenment is long. I don't know how to shorten that. So anyway, that forum, you could, you know, contribute. And in that, by sharing, you know, special prayers that you use for upliftment, you know, is there an enlightenment story you want to share? I do daily energy work on the blog, so you can tap in that way. We can do group work and keep building. My guest is there. And keep building the energy so when world enlightenment happens, it will be awesome. All right, let's see. Yes. Oh, my goodness. Wait. Whoops. Go back. There you are. Ooh, are we on? I can see you. There we go.
There we go. Oh, goodness.
Let's get rid of that.
Kathy,
it's been a long time. How are you?
I'm cold and tired. It's been a long day. It's midnight here where I am, and I've been doing, get this hair out of the way, I've been doing back-to-back radio shows, and then my website went down, so I had to get that back up and going. And anyways, it's been a long, bad day, and it's cold and damp. That's why I'm wearing my... Yeah, I'm north of Toronto, northwest of Toronto in farm country.
Okay, well, that's cold. I mean, even for Hawaii, it's dark at 6, and I had to put a sweater on.
Is that right? Really? even for Hawaii. Look at you. Yeah, you.
I know.
That looks like a nice comfy sweater.
It is. You know, it's just be warm and functional, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on. We're going to talk about your new book. But before we get into that, because I have two of your other books, we're going to
get out
really quickly. You have been on my show before. Come on. I do keep the good ones, you know.
Oh, my God. Well, thank you for buying those books. It really helps. It's really nice of you. Thank you.
Okay. The Blind Zen. That was my curious one. You're going to have to talk about that. I mean, sure. Wait, before we get into that, let me explain who you are, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
And thank God I have one of your
I'm books. Curious to hear who I am because I don't know either.
Well, let me say you're no longer looking like this picture, okay?
Well, that picture is now 15 years old.
We all change. I know, but I'm just saying, okay. All right, about the author. Now, if I'm mispronouncing your name, let me know, okay? Stefan or Stephen? I always think that's... Because I know you're Canadian, but eh.
But no, actually, Dutch extraction, so it would be Stefan.
Stefan. I like that better than Stephen.
Yeah, me too.
Verstappen.
That's right. Yeah, wow. That's right.
Okay. Is a Canadian writer, adventurer, and martial artist. He has worked as a wilderness survival instructor for Outward Bound programs, a street youth counselor, a first aid and CPR instructor in St. John Ambulance, and a martial arts instructor. Since first backpacking through Europe alone at age 16, he has also traveled the world and spent 4 years living in the Orient. You know, like I said before when you were on my show, you're just one handy guy to have around.
Yes, I am. But it's sort of like I'm like Forrest Gump. In the sense that you find yourself in all these remarkable situations quite by accident. So all those things I've done, it's all been kind of by accident, you know.
Well, you know, you may not have planned them in this lifetime, but you definitely planned them before you came down into this lifetime. And,
well,
they're all stepping stones to make you what you are.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I owe it all to my mother because she was a psychopath.
Do I want to touch that one?
No, but the thing was she didn't have any maternal instinct. I'm an only child, no father, no uncles, no grandparents, nothing. You know, I only had this monster for a mother. And she wasn't interested in raising children, so she left me alone most of my childhood. But she figured out that if she bought me things that would occupy my time, she could leave me alone. The neighbors used to tell stories. They'd come over to the house, and they'd be there for hours, and they'd go, where's Stefan? Well, he's in his playpen. And then they'd go and take a look, and I'd be in the playpen building blocks and mechanical. So what she did was she bought me stuff that would occupy my time. She bought me encyclopedias and books and chemistry sets and electronic sets and mechanical sets and paint sets. And so by the time I was in microscopes and telescopes and, you know, because she would give me a microscope and I'm gone for 2 weeks. She doesn't have to look after me, right? Because I'm looking at the microscope. So because and it's kind of curious because a lot of people that are kind of talented in some way are often been neglected as children. And so what they do is they search for meaning in other things. So I was into science and into I wanted to be a mad scientist and a painter and an architect and a mechanic and so I learned all those skills at a very early age. And then I kept going that way. You know, when I was 16, I went to Europe to backpack there by myself throughout Europe. And that ruined me for life, you know. But before I went to Europe, I was part of the Outward Bound program, you know. So when I told my mother, I said, listen, I'm going to Europe alone. And she said, well, that's okay, because after all, you've been through all, you've been alone through the forests of Northern Ontario. How much more dangerous could Europe be than... So it gave me the kind of courage and the inquisitiveness and the curiosity to pursue a lot of different avenues. And so that's why I am the man I am today. But you're right, Kathy. We are put on this planet right now because we are in a turning point of history. We are in a cosmic battle against evil. And everybody that's incarnated now, and I think there's probably more people alive today than have ever existed on this planet, this might be the final test for everyone's soul. How are you going to react in this battle? What side are you going to choose, good or evil? And so I think all of my skills that I've learned throughout my lifetime all come into play now because, well, you know, I'm a warrior. And this is a battle of good against evil. So I think maybe you're right. Maybe I planned all this before I came here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, you look back at your life after you get older, at least I did, and why I did what I did fell into place. And I didn't know I was being put on a shaman path when my mother died at 14. You know, yeah. They made you a loner, and then you do... weirdest things. You know, you're becoming a shaman, and again, you're put through a lot of initiations, and you don't know you're going through them until you're older, if you're lucky, and you're able to look back at your life and went, oh, okay. Or in my case, they actually put together like 8 shaman in a very special session in Ann Arbor. And I got to go see it. And each one of the shaman described exactly what I went through, except they explained why you went through it. And it's like, oh, okay. And I never really accepted the word shaman until a tourist came in, and he literally sent me a bear claw that was 30,000 year old out of the Pyrenees mountain that he said came out of the shaman cave. And he said, actually belonged to me. And I went, who am I? Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, shaman is much easier than a witch. Witches get burned at the stake. Other people,
yes, they do.
Shaman. What's a shaman, right? Okay. Let's focus on her. But you've written a lot of survival books, and the one we're going to talk about, because I have it in my hand, is The Art of Urban Survival. And it was fascinating because you touch on all kinds of bases. You know, it's like you've taken all your knowledge and, you know, put it down. I mean, I'm just going to read because I do have the table of contents before me. Dig. Okay. Yeah. Surviving predators, the psychopath, you know, and this is how to be able to discern what a psychopath is. Lies and deception, anger and aggression, you know, what causes it and how to be able to tell when it's happening with somebody. This is really important because you're taking all your gifts and your skills and what really should be ours, and you're teaching us how to take all our senses and use them in practical ways.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to send you a PDF copy of my book, The Way of the Warrior. You will really like that because I talk about the relationship between the warrior path and shamanism. I have a great affinity for shamanism. I was inducted into the Bear Clan by my Kung Fu brother, who was a Indian shaman. And I have the same as you. I have the bear tooth, and we did the ceremony, you know, burned the sweet grass. We were in the swamp, the menacing swamp. He taught me how to trap and hunt, and he was my kung fu brother when I went to Asia, when I went to China. We trained together. We also, when we were in Thailand, it was his idea. He said, I want to go see a shaman. And so we traveled to the north of Thailand. We went to Chiang Mai and then to Chiang Rai. And there we hired a guide to take us up into the Golden Triangle. And the Golden Triangle is a territory that sort of undefined, kind of a wilderness area. No government really controls it. It's so far up in the hinterland, but it's on the border between Thailand, Laos, and Burma or Myanmar. And that's also the source of most of the opium and heroin in the world. So we went up there and, you know, it was like, have you ever seen the movie Apocalypse Now, where they get on that boat? Well, we were on that boat. We were on the Fang River, which was a tributary of the Mekong. And the further up the river we got, the more primitive the people became. You know, they were, you know, close to the where we set off, they were wearing T-shirts and jeans. But by the time we got to the end of the river trip, they were in traditional costume, which was like a black weave with all these brightly colored patches woven in. And the women wore like turbans, but the turbans were decorated with silver coins. And wow, beautiful. Anyways, we then took an elephant up over some mountains, and because our guide Utai, he was he qualified himself by saying that he used to be a jewel smuggler. That area of the world is very famous for rubies and sapphires, and they would smuggle it out of the area into the markets of Asia, and he was a smuggler. And so, well, okay, I guess he knows his way around. We went up there, we had numerous adventures. I could tell stories and stories. But anyways, we finally got to one of the villages, and this is all bamboo villages, you know, bamboo houses, bamboo floors, built, you know, 3 feet above the ground, and all the little pigs would run around underneath the house. And we finally found a Ka Ren shaman or witch doctor. And because that's what we were looking for. We went from village to village. You know, Utai would go and ask the village headman, have you seen the shaman around? And he said, no, he's not here, but he's over in the next village. So then we would go to the next village. Have you seen the shaman around? No, we go there. Finally, we found him. Now, before we got to get together with him, they said, do you want to smoke some opium? Now, this is like real opium, right? So we went into a hut, again, a bamboo hut, and this old, old man with leathery skin and wearing basically a diaper and a turban, he was the opium master, and he prepared bowls of opium. Anyways, we smoked, oh my God, I think it was 15 bowls of opium. I asked Utai, how much should we smoke? He said, well, no more than 3 bowls. We smoked 15. So we were completely blasted, but it's not like people see in the movies. It's you don't hallucinate or anything like that. It's just you're just very relaxed. Opium is a great pain reliever. As a matter of fact, I wish they would prescribe opium at pharmacies, because it's a lot better than most of the drugs they prescribe. Anyways, we finally met the Ka Ren, and the Ka Ren is an indigenous tribe. That's, you know, they live up in the mountains there between Thailand, between Burma, between Laos. And we started to dance the spirit. You know what I'm talking about. And so my Kung Fu brother and I, we started to do the Kung Fu we learned. But we did the animal styles, because you're dancing the spirit. And so you dance your guardian spirit, basically. And we started to do our tiger and crane dance. And it was funny, because the shaman, and we were surrounded by the entire village. It was magical. Kathy was on the top of a mountain. It was a full moon. And you could see, you know, the hills of the mountain stretch out into the distance with the fog in between the valleys. And we were at that kind of a clearing surrounded by these bamboo huts and houses. And there was the old shaman, and he was dancing with us. And we were surrounded by the entire village and all the village children. And afterwards, the shaman started berating all the young men. He said he hadn't seen anyone dance this spirit since he was a child, which again brought me back, made the connection for me, which is in my book, The Way of the Warrior. I'm going to send you a PDF after we're done here. And it's The Warrior as Shaman. But it made the connection to me that the Way of the Warrior is an old remnant of shamanism. And so if you study Kung Fu and you study Tiger Style, what really you're doing is you're getting in touch with the old shamanic traditions of dancing your spirit. And this old shaman was berating all the youth there saying, look, how can these foreigners know what I've been trying to teach you for 20 years, you know? But I have a great affinity for shamanism, and I try to explain it in the book, The Way of the Warrior. It is a way of drawing energy and strength from nature. And when you are empowered with the spirit of nature, you become really strong. So, Kathy, I'm with you on the shamanism thing. Trust me.
Cool. So, all right, let's jump to the blind zone. Okay. Just quickly, what is it about? I found it fascinating, but I want you to just tell people what it is.
Okay, well, I was teaching Kung Fu at the local community center in a small town, Bolton, Ontario. And the local newspaper did a couple of stories on me. You know, Kung Fu comes to Bolton and so on. I get a phone call from somebody that saw the story and said, you know, I'm really interested in private lessons. Can you teach me? I said, sure. And she said, well, can you pick me up and drive me to the dojo? I was sharing a dojo with a karate school. And I said, and that was kind of an unusual request, pick you up and drive you there. I said, so on a hunch, I said, are you disabled? And she says, yes, you're probably going to think this is crazy, but I'm handicapped. Can you teach handicapped? Now, I said, yes, of course, anyone can learn Kung Fu, because there's actually an old tradition among the village Kung Fu masters that parents that had a child that was sickly would send them to the Kung Fu master. And under the training and administration, because the other thing, too, is that Kung Fu masters traditionally in China were also healers. I love that idea. I love the idea that if you're going to spend all this time learning how to kill people, you should spend an equal amount of time learning how to heal them. And both my teachers in Hong Kong and in Taipei were primarily doctors. That's how they earned their living. And their teachers were doctors, and their teachers' teachers were doctors. It stretches all the way back. Lam Sai Wing, Hong Shi Guan, they were all quite famous Chinese medicine doctors. But also very famous Kung Fu masters. As a matter of fact, so famous that, you know, about 50% of the Kung Fu movies you see come out of China are based on them. So I had like sterling pedigree when it came to Kung Fu. And so in the traditional Kung Fu schools and their societies, parents would send their sickly kids that couldn't work on the farm, that couldn't work in the rice fields, to the Kung Fu master, and it was these children that ended up becoming the greatest Kung Fu masters, because they came from, you know, a point of weakness and illness, and they grew and they became strong and powerful, and they realized the benefits of training and Chinese medicine and herbs and meditation and training outdoors where you absorb the chi, the energy from nature. And so they became the greatest Kung Fu masters. So when she asked me, well, can you teach me? I Well, according to tradition, I can. So I said, I don't know. I've never taught. I said, what kind of disability do you have? She says, I'm blind. Oh, geez, how am I going to do this, right? I said, listen, I'll try. Let's give it a try. It's going to be trial and error. I'll bring you over to the dojo, and I'll see if I can teach you. Now, surprisingly, there is a huge tradition in Japan and in China of blind martial arts masters. So in the 60s, 70s Kung Fu series, Kung Fu, Master Po, who was the master for Kwai Chan Kane or David Carradine, he was blind, and he was a great master. And in Japan, we have a similar tradition with the character known as Zatoichi. And he was a swordsman, and he was also blind, but he was a deadly swordsman. So there is a precedent that blind people could learn martial arts. And, well, we began training, and I also did a lot of research at the same time. And I was researching things that I was interested in already, and that is how to improve your senses, how to improve your awareness, how to improve your abilities. Because I believe it was Moshe Feldenkrais that said, you know, we learn something only until we're adequate at it, and then we stop. So he says everybody can speak, but it's only a professional speaker that has to go beyond and master speaking and master his tone of voice and master eloquence and to be an orator. But most people never get there because as soon as they reach the functional level at what they wanted to attain, they stop. Well, this is true for us too. We all can see, well, except for those who are blind. But actually, we don't try to develop our vision beyond that. I can see, so we don't try to see beyond it. Now, as you know, I'm also an artist. And as an artist, you have to see differently than other people. You have to train yourself. So an artist has to see shadow, light, contrast. You have to tell, for example, we look and we see shadow, but an artist will see different shades of color. A shadow is not just dark. A shadow is blue or purple, right? And most of us won't see blue or purple unless we are trained to look that way. Same thing with hearing. We can all hear, those of us that can hear, no, except for the deaf. But the level of hearing can be developed far beyond what we hear. For example, what I would do with the woman, Susan, in the book is part of the lessons would be what I would call walking lessons. And that would simply be me taking her for a walk through town because she was, you know, she was really terribly frightened to go out on her own and would immediately get lost and didn't know how to get around town. She couldn't get to the local store. But going for a walking lesson, we would focus on hearing and also olfaction, but I'll get into that later. So we would walk down the street and I would say, what do you hear? There's a noise in the bushes. Now I could look and see it's a squirrel, but she can't look and see it's a squirrel. Is it somebody sneaking up on her? Is it a dog? Is it a bear? You know, how would she tell that noise was a squirrel? It wasn't until I began to identify all the noises to her. What's that? And I would say, okay, that's a squirrel. And then she would register, okay, that's the noise that makes. And then we would talk about the background noises. So there's a gas station on the corner, and you can hear the cars pull up, and they would run over the. In those days, we used to have these hoses across the wire across the entrance, and it would go bing, bing, you know, as you drove in into the gas station, and you could hear the pumps and that. And so once she understood that, when she heard that noise, she was now at the corner. And that at the corner, she needed to make a left turn to get to the store. Now, as she's walking towards the store, she's going to go over a bridge, and under the bridge is a stream. Now she can hear the stream. And once you get over to the stream, you go past some oak trees. and you can hear the wind rustling in the oak trees. So by using her sense of hearing and fine-tuning it, she was able to now find her way around town. First, I'm going to head in the direction where I hear the gas station and the traffic and the cars. Then I'm going to turn left until I hear the sound of running water. Then I'm going to keep going and then turn right when I hear the sound of rustling leaves. And so by improving hearing and smell, too, because smell plays an important part. For example, when we walk, when we get around somewhere, we use visual landmarks. Usually we have a map, but once we've been there, we know, oh, there's the church on the up ahead, and then there's the little strip mall behind that, and then I turn left there, and I make a right at the schoolyard, and it's called a visual landscape, and that's how we navigate it. But for the blind, they don't have a landscape. So I helped her to create a olfactory landscape and an audio landscape. So now she could tell where she was in town based on the sounds she heard. Now the sound of the gas station is far away, so she knows she's further into town. And the sound of the rustling leaves are slightly in the distance, and the sound of running water, we've already passed that. And so I could put her anywhere in town and ask her, where are you? And she would be able to give me a correct answer. The other thing, too, is olfactory. You know, when we walked down her street, there were pine trees on the neighbor's front yard about a block away, and you can smell the pine trees, you know. And so when she was walking in that direction and you could smell the pine trees, now she knows she's two blocks from her home. And so anyways, I investigated this, because I was doing this for myself as well. I wanted to improve my senses. And we would do things like, if we were walking and there were people walking behind me, I would ask her, who's walking behind us? How many people? 1, 2, 3. Are they men or are they women? Are they young or are they old? You can tell all that by sound, right? So it really became a learning experience for her, but also a learning experience for me. And so Blind Zen tells the story of how we kind of discovered all of this. And that's when I first came upon the concept of synesthesia. Have you heard of this term before?
No.
Synesthesia. Synesthesia affects about 2% of the population. And it's a very curious effect. It's an effect whereby the senses cross over and create unique sensations. For example, a person who is a synesthetic, they could hear music, and at the same time, they would see color. And it would be consistent. So if you played a D major chord on the piano and ask a synesthetic, what do you see? They would see purple. They would see purple anytime you played a D major. Or they could touch a fabric, and the texture, the feel of the texture of the fabric would make them hear a sound, a musical note. Or they could smell coffee, and at the same time, they would feel a texture. So the olfactory, the vision, the hearing, and the tactile senses all kind of intermingled somewhere deep in the brain. It's part of the brain that processes sensation, but it kind of mixes things up, and they tend to be very creative people. Because not only do they hear music, when they hear music, they see color, they feel texture, and even the sensations would have a taste to them. So they could, you know, smell pine trees and they would taste it. Or they could see a color and they would hear it. And so that's what a synesthetic is. Now, my hunch is that when we have instinct and intuition, which is very important skills to develop and to learn, because they are dead on. You know, it's like a sixth sense. We actually have 9 or 12 senses. But what we traditionally had called a sixth sense, if you had, you know, a hunch about something or a feeling about something, because what I found out is this synesthesia, everyone has it. But what happens is the brain automatically suppresses this kind of information from reaching your frontal cortex. So in other words, you're not aware of it, personally aware of it, but it's there. It's just below the surface. You maybe call it the subconscious, but the synesthesia is just there below the surface. And my hunch is that this is what contributes to a lot of what we would call a sixth sense. And we can see it reflected in our language. Oh, it smells fishy. is that your synesthesia? Is that your senses picking up all the subtle clues about a person, and it's translating as an unpleasant smell, which is the warning sign that this person is not right. This person may be dangerous or is a predator. And therefore, we interpret it as a bad smell. But it may be because our senses are so acute. We pick up things that doesn't register in the prefrontal cortex. It doesn't register, oh, I, Kathy, now see this. But your eyes still see. And that information is naturally suppressed because the theory is that if we were to have access to all this information, we would kind of go mad with the overload, too much information overload. And we'd have a hard time concentrating because we'd be immersed in sensation. So the brain naturally suppresses it a little bit, but it's there. You see things, you hear things, you sense things.
You know, we can do a 24-hour show. And we've got to talk about your new book, okay? It's about creating community. So why did you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book to save mankind.
Cool. Man with a mission.
To save Western civilization. I know it's a big claim to make, but I've been through this and I've investigated. Let's first start off with one premise, and that is Western civilization is doomed to collapse. We can see this coming. Things are not getting better. Things are getting worse. And there's a very good chance that the world we once knew will cease to exist. It's already happened. I don't recognize the world anymore. The world of my childhood was completely different than this madness that we're living in now. It's gone completely insane. And I grieve. I grieve, Kathy, because I remember the halcyon days of youth in the summer, and when people cared about each other, when people helped each other, when people were friendly and honest and looked after each other. And
you didn't wear a mask, and you could go out and play outside for the whole day, and mom didn't care as long as you go into the second woods, you would be home before dark.
Yep.
We literally walked in. I know people say this, I'm from the Upper Peninsula. I'm from Michigan, around Detroit area. So we had some hellacious snowstorms where, we had snow days. And when we didn't have snow days, we walked a good 2 miles to school and didn't even think about it. And we're thrilled when we got to ride our bikes.
Yeah.
And no masks. We got to breathe. The lakes were clean.
Yes.
Oh, my God. The air, there wasn't chemtrails in the sky. The kids nowadays, they have no clue.
No.
And they're used to being this now.
Yeah. And skies used to be blue back then, a rich
fluffy
blue.
Clouds, not stripes, right?
Yeah.
Like Mother Nature went to the Wicked Witch of the West in her broom and, she's making, they're not clouds, I know, but they're coming out with it finally and they're admitting to it.
Yeah.
But yes, it's crazy times.
Yeah, it's crazy times. And so, I wrote an article for Gerald Celente's magazine, The Trends Journal, called historical cycles, are we doomed to repeat the past? Because I'm also interested in history. Like I said, my mother gave me all these books, and I've been a voracious reader ever since. And I love history. And the theory of historical cycles is, and many historians have come up with this theory, and that is civilizations rise and fall in a predictable cycle. And we are in the end stage of a cycle. Typically, a civilization lasts about 250 years, and then it goes through a period of decline and collapse. And then after the collapse, it rises again like a phoenix out of the ashes, and there's a new civilization that's built on the ruins of the old. Well, you look at history, it's an endless series of cycles. This civilization collapses, and then another one rises up. But the problem is, during the age of collapse, you're looking at 5 to 50 years of hell on earth, where everything is gone. No hospitals, no grocery stores, no police department, no emergency services, criminals running amok, gangs, warlords, slavery, starvation.
I'm so glad this is October, because this is Halloween story, but true. I'm getting scared enough because it's true. And look what they're doing with the police department and the military, nurses, doctors who won't take the you know what. Right. And they're getting rid of them. And why are they doing this to the military? Are they bringing in a private military?
Yes, they are.
Place them.
Yeah. A private military that will only protect the bankers and the politicians. The rest of us, it's going to be every man for himself.
Yeah, wow.
So we are, going, this is a natural cycle. It's like the riddle of the Sphinx. You've heard that story, right? The riddle of the Sphinx.
No.
What walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three legs in the evening? Man. You're born a baby and you're crawling on all fours, and you grow into a young man, and then you're walking on two legs, and then you get older and you need a cane to get around. So it's a natural cycle: spring, summer, fall, winter. As civilizations go through those cycles too, we're heading towards the winter phase of our civilization. It seems to be inevitable. Every civilization, every Chinese dynasty, the Rome and Persia and Babylon and Egypt, they all went through all these phases. It's our turn to go through that phase now too, but we're going into the winter phase, or the collapse phase, or as I talk about it in my article, it's the age of chaos, where all that breaks down. Now, the age of chaos can last anywhere from 5 to 50 years. Sometimes even a couple of hundred years, you get a long dark age, and during that time, things are bad: hunger, famine, disease, crime, natural disasters seem to occur more often during that phase. I don't know what the correlation is, but usually when the civilization goes into the age of chaos, you have floods and hurricanes and volcanoes, and look what's going on now. I don't know why it's almost, well, we know why, because it's kind of a spiritual trial. Not only is your the people and the civilization collapsing, but now you get an extra test by the world at large is giving you grief.
Yeah, but that comes from the HARP and the CERN and the direct energy weapons. That's not Mother Nature causing that bull crap. And
exactly.
If we go down, they're going to go down, because they're not going to have electricity unless they've already figured out, which they have. So we don't have much time left. So what can we do to create a community?
Okay, so that was the point of my book and the point of my online course, which is being run through the University of Reason. So anyways, I'm examining history. I know what's coming. It's going to be bad. We need help to get through it. I'm a survivalist. That's the book, The Art of Urban Survival, which is, basically a prediction of how the things go down, right? Crime and war and corruption and martial law and riots and it's all in the book, how to survive that. But now, what's the big picture of surviving what's coming? And again, looking at history to see what our ancestors did, the best way to survive is to form small, autonomous, parallel societies. This is the only way we're going to make it. We have to work together. Like I say in the course, the difference between the elite psychopaths that rule the world and of all of us that are struggling to earn a living and fighting to survive is that they belong to a mutual aid society. It's a secret society, you know, and the bonds that hold them together, of course, is the rape and murder of children, which forms pretty strong bonds, but they have each other's backs. For example, you know, if you were a member of the Skull and Bones, when you graduate Yale, you find yourself with $250,000 in your bank account, and you get offers from all the top corporations for primary jobs, and you get references, and you meet all the big players, and that's a mutual aid society. That's how they became billionaires and trillionaires, because they supported each other. They gave, you know, they put in their money and they bought the banks and they bought the businesses and all of us are all by ourselves. And most of us don't even have family, you know, because I've spoken to a lot of people and, you know, people can't get along, you know, brothers and sisters arguing, bickering, parents arguing, bickering, you know, so while we're all arguing, bickering and fighting amongst each other, the billionaires are working together, pooling all their money to buy every TV station, to buy every newspaper, to buy and to implement this program that they're forcing down our throats right now. If we were to cooperate, we could defeat them because we outnumber them 7 billion to 1. There's no way they could win, but they have been successful through their programming and their brainwashing and their media and their public education of, first of all, making us dumb, making us helpless and dependent on the state, and making us bicker and fight amongst each other. Now, if we can just drop the bickering and work together, pool our own resources, then we can do for ourselves what the government used to do. And this is what our grandparents did. They did it through mutual aid societies, friendly societies, fraternal societies. They pooled their money together for the equivalent of one day's pay per month. They were able to provide all their medical care. They built their own hospitals. They were able to provide scholarships for their students. They were able to buy farmland and grow their own food. This is what we need to do. We have to recreate all these facets of society for ourselves. And we can only do that through communities. We have to provide our own medical care, our own security. You know, we got to get together. If there's a problem in the neighborhood, all the boys come out with their shotguns and they deal with it. We need to grow our own food and source our own food sources. We need to establish our own communications networks, because if the internet goes down and the power goes down, how are you going to know what's going on? But I'm already setting it up, communications networks through ham radios and even CB radios and walkie-talkies. All of them can be used. And we need to create our own shelter and produce our own food. And we need to do this together, because one person can't do it. So my book is on how to form a community, how to work together, and how to supply all the needs that we are going to need in the next few years when the hospitals are gone and the grocery stores are closed and the power has been turned off. So this is what we need to do for ourselves.
Well, and even before that, you know, and rumor has it that they're going to start putting the jabs in food.
Mm-hmm.
More important now than ever to get together with a group of people to grow food. And, you know, they always say grow enough for whoever you're growing for, and then always grow extra.
Always, so always.
To share with the community.
Yes, to barter and trade. And I put that in the book too. No matter how much you have, put 10% of that aside for the general community, not just your inner circle of people or whatever, but because, you know, your next door neighbor, maybe he's not a prepper, he didn't store food or anything like that, but they got three little girls. You want to watch those three little girls starve to death? If I had 2 years supply of food, am I going to sit here and hoard it all to myself and let all the little children? I mean, it's not their fault they were born in this time. It's not their fault their parents didn't get prepared. So what, I'm going to sit back and watch, or, you know, I stockpile antibiotics. If the little girl or the little boy next door, he's got bronchial pneumonia, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to give him 25 caplets of 500 milligrams of amoxicillin. I will save his life with my stockpile of antibiotics. And then we could follow it up with herbal medicines and treatments and things like that. It's not just that, you know, I have a problem with the prepper community because they're always like, well, I'm going to survive. And if my next door neighbor is too stupid to, and if he comes to my door, I'm going to shoot him. Oh, come on, you know, get real for Christ's sakes. You know, I don't want to survive if surviving means I have to become a brutal tyrant to everybody else. I know people say, oh, well, it's going to get, yeah, dog eat dog. No, no, still, no matter what, I'm strong. You know me. I'm a martial arts master. I'm not afraid of anybody. So I don't have to worry about that. So I can give a little bit of myself to the rest of the world. Now, if we all form these communities and we all can give a little bit to the rest of the world, then and when this is over, we have to rebuild society. And who's going to do it? Those of us that belong to communities that have the resources, have the training, have the talent. We're going to have to go back out into the world and rebuild society again. And usually what happens is that this new society is really good for 150 years, really good. So that's what the book is about. That's what the online course is about.
So how can they find you and find your book?
So I got a new website. I'm still working on it, but it's formingcommunities.com. Formingcommunities.com. And the course will be on there. The book will be on there. And, of course, my old website is chinastrategies.com. And that has all my old stuff on there. Well, it has everything on there, all my books and my martial arts and my art and my nature videos, you know, my canoe videos, everything's on there. But for what's coming up, formingcommunities.com. And the course is the perfect venue to get started. You need 2-3 people to start. Find 2 other people, take the course. Watch the course together. I mean, there's 16 hours on there. I did this wow. course. Yeah, it was eight sessions, 2.5 hours each, and then question and answer and all that. I hated doing it, Kathy. I hated doing it, but I had to do it because, you know, I can't go around to everywhere and personally talk people through the whole process. Mm-hmm. So. And there's nobody else that's going to be able to talk you through the process because nobody studied it as much as I had. Maybe 6 other people in the world could do this. I don't know. But if you take the course together, you stop the course after every lesson, discuss it amongst yourselves. What do you think? What should we do? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you like his idea? Do you like that suggestion? This way you start to build a consensus and you get a really good idea of what to do. And by the end of the course, at the end of the, is it 16 hours? I don't know. You will know everything I know. Plus, you'll get the book, which will go into the details, you know, the contracts you need, how to register, how to incorporate, how to write a mission statement, how to do a charter and bylaws and meeting protocols. I mean, you need all that stuff, too, because people don't know how to work together anymore. So we need to lay this all out. And that's your best hope of forming a community, because if you don't form a community, you know, for me, survival is not huddled in the basement with my shotgun waiting for the squirrel trap to catch a squirrel. This, you don't want to survive like that. What my picture of surviving what's coming is a community of people that care about each other and you have story night, and you have music night, and you have potluck dinner, and you are safe, and you're warm, and you're comfortable, and you're well fed. And if anybody gets sick, we've got a little tent set up, or we got a room in somebody's house. We got nurses to look after you. We got former EMTs. Look, we need to survive healthy and comfortable, but also.
On that note, I'm going to cut you off. We've already gone through the hour. How
quick. Okay. Yeah, I know.
We're going to have to do this again because you've got too much information.
I do. I have too much.
Well, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This is Kathy Bilski, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite Show, October 22nd, 2021. Have a safe week. You cannot use Mercury in retrograde for any excuse now because we are out of it. So thank you, Stefan. And we will do this again. So
thanks, Kathy. You take care. Bye-bye.